hppodcraft.com.
Hello, folks, and welcome to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chris Lackey.
And I'm Chad Pfeiffer. Although separated by an ocean, we have found our way back together again here, exclusively on Patreon.
It's magical.
Well, Chris, magical things can happen every day if you just keep your eyes open and your heart young and your imagination thriving and your friends in a cellar.
What?
Like a rabbit from a hat, you get away with it. Huh? That's the message of today's show. You put some people in a cellar for their own good and nobody catches you. It's magic. Poof, you didn't do anything wrong. It's amazing.
This is our November comment show covering the Ray Bradbury stories from the October Country and our Halloween bonus episode. You guys had lots of interesting stuff to say, so let's get into it, starting with The Jar. Kelly Frank writes, "Love this episode. Bradbury's gift for words is unmatched. Heart emoji. Mm-hmm. You know, as someone who actually does collect bones and things in jars, it's not always clear what you're looking at when it's not a recognizable body part. Maybe Charlie's wife, in lying about the thing in the jar being fashioned from wire and such, gave him an idea for creating his own monstrosity. Mismatched flesh, some hair, an eye, and you could pull off something vaguely human but seemingly otherworldly. He's had plenty of time to listen to speculation and get creative ideas. Just throwing this bit out too. Drowned cat. Cat that kept going into heat and having litters. Here, kitty kitty. Tomcat. That's some damn good writing."
Daisy agreed and said, "I really enjoyed this episode. My cat, Bing, not so much. She was sitting with me listening, and then that aggressive here, kitty kitty line, and she bolted off my lap and hid under the tape."
Aww.
I was worried about that when we picked that story. You know, we should have run a disclaimer for our cat listeners at the beginning of the show.
Oh.
You know, letting them know there was going to be some violent cat content in there.
Right.
We at least did that for the black cat episode this month, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
We're very concerned about our cat listeners.
Jennifer DeFord writes, "My mother once told me that there was a traveling educator who went around to schools in the 1950s in southeastern Virginia, where she was a student, showing off an honest-to-God mummy. You know, for the kids. I've never been so appalled and so jealous at the same time. The story reminds me of that."
Yeah, I'm jealous for sure. I would have loved that. Jonathan Alvis writes, "This was a great episode and great story. The phenomenon of exhibiting spooky things in jars, usually fetal animals, but occasionally fetal humans, amongst all manner of other things, was known as pickled punks by carny folk. They were still showing versions of them as late as the 1980s at the Mississippi State Fair, along with other hokey freak show oddities, although I'm certain by then human fetuses were not being displayed."
Yeah, I'm not certain.
Glad you're sure. "The tradition of using human remains in various capacities by carnies seems to have been very strong and puts me in mind of the Elmer McCurdy story. From probably the late 60s until 1976, a California amusement park unknowingly used an actual human corpse hanging from a gallows in one of its fun houses."
Huh?
"There's lots more to the story that a quick search of the name Elmer McCurdy should reveal." And of course, I did look it up immediately. Elmer J. McCurdy, who was born in 1880, was an American bank and train robber who was killed in a shootout with police after robbing a train in Oklahoma in October 1911. Dubbed the Bandit Who Wouldn't Give Up, which is an awesome appellation. Wow. His mummified body was first put on display at an Oklahoma funeral home and then became a fixture on the traveling carnival and sideshow circuit during the 1920s through the 1960s. Wow. So for 40 years, this body was getting toured around. Wow. After changing ownership several times, McCurdy's remains eventually wound up at the Pike Amusement Zone in Long Beach, California, where they were discovered by a film crew and positively identified in December 1976.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so for a very long time, that body was just flying around entertaining people. In April 1977, Elmer McCurdy's body was buried at the Summit View Cemetery in Guthrie, Oklahoma. His whole story is pretty interesting and worth reading about, so I recommend folks look up Elmer J. McCurdy, McCurdy. It's pretty interesting stuff. Thanks, Jonathan, for hipping me to that.
Next up, Lisa, Hackodiomaniacal. "Years ago, I went to a fair that had freak animals with extra limbs, pickled pig fetuses and such. I think I went in because I had a sense it was going away as a thing. It was so bloody hot, August in the Midwest, the tent was full of flies, which massed around extra limbs where the animals couldn't feel. I spent my time worldly scratching and petting. It's become my modus operandi. The people manning the tent seemed very impersonal and unhappy, like farmers that had gotten in beyond their depth."
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, just standing around while people ogle some kind of mutant animals.
Yeah.
Hard to find employees to meet that challenge, but... Yes. Steve writes, "I think people see in the jar what they have lost, and Tom has never lost before, which is why he doesn't see anything until he loses Thede. I think she's dead, but not in the jar." He continues, "I love Levi's reading, and I enjoyed the episode as ever, although I've never got on with Bradbury, except for his Mars stories. I really can't put a finger on why." Okay. Brandon writes, "I watched the Ray Bradbury Theater episode this weekend. Amazon Prime has it. It's very, very close to the text, but it gives Thede a tattoo, which Tom sees in the jar at the end." it comes down on the side of, yes, that was actually Thede or some
right.
part of her in the jar. And Bradbury was pretty involved in those episodes. I think he wrote most of them, so I don't know if it's worthwhile. I like the ambiguity in these stories, so if you watch the episode, you're going to find out what he really thought was going on, and
right.
I don't think that's a lot of fun. So,
yeah.
It does a disservice to the stories a little bit, I think.
And that gets us into Skeleton. Danielle writes, Chad, I was in Skeletor. This is now officially the most homoerotic episode ever. Awesome how you came out and shared like that, especially timeful as it is National Coming Out Week. You rock, Chad.
Aw, well, thanks, Danielle. This is what I've tried to explain to my family. I'm not, like, stereotypically famous, but in the community of dudes who enjoy being inside of Skeletors, I'm a f***ing icon. That's what I try and tell. What do you think of that, Uncle Bob? Can you handle my generation? That's how I come at it with my family. Danielle had more to say about this story, Skeleton.
On a slightly more serious note, speaking as a trans person, this is nothing at all like how I feel. I have never thought that my Y chromosomes are planning against me, nor have I ever thought that my genitals arranged a car accident to kill me.
I'm not a trans person, but I have had that sensation that my genitals are arranging a car accident. That's weird, huh? Until that was mentioned, I don't think I've thought of, but yeah, that's something that happens kind of more frequently than you would think to me.
Wow. Yeah, I don't think that has any bearing on what we're talking about right now, Chad, but
sure.
That's a whole other
just
subject.
Relating to stuff, man. Just
sure, sure. Yeah, you want to connect to people. I understand.
I do. Find some meaning.
I don't like the body I was born in because it does not match my identity. That simple statement does come with a lot of attendant emotional baggage. The important thing I mean to point out is that I do not think my body is a separate, intelligent entity that is trying to kill me. To be honest, this does not sound like body dysmorphia, but rather paranoid schizophrenia.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah.
Certainly could be thought of in that way. Steve writes, I think Bradbury's sexist attitudes would not only get him into trouble, but they were also wrong. True, I didn't actually say that.
Yeah.
I don't agree with what he said about
sexism. No. I think, because we've been doing the show so long, we get the sense that people know us, that it's implied that he was wrong about those attitudes. But let's just be explicit about it. He was wrong about those attitudes.
Yeah, I'm also not going to spend a lot of time editorializing.
Of course.
My opinions of what the author should think or not. But yes, that stuff is wrong. And Steve goes on to say, also, now that Chris has mentioned it, I think his sentimentality is what I don't like about Bradbury.
Yeah.
Fair enough. I mean, that is a complaint that a lot of people have.
Mm-hmm.
For me, that is why I like it.
Corey Wittig writes, I logged in to wish Chris well with his flatulence problem. Oh, thanks. It's still going on, so if anybody's got any advice on certain kinds of foods I can eat, or maybe some sort of probacterial kind of thing I could eat that would lessen my farts, you know, please do. John Hancock writes, a terrible disappointment to see how standards have slipped at this once great podcast. Gentlemen, I was expecting half an hour of wall-to-wall boner jokes, but barely a sniff. Still, I did at least learn why people refer to Chris as Jumpin' Jack Flash.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that, John. We should have made some boner jokes in there. But you know what? I'm going to give you this one for free.
Sure.
You know that song, Owner of a Lonely Heart?
Yes.
Okay, well, when you're singing along with it, you want to say, Boner of a Lonely Heart instead. Classic.
Yeah, I think that was pretty classic when I was 12 years old. Yeah. I remember that was a good one.
And it lasts. I mean, it's still funny. You just laughed. You knew where I was going with it, too. Christine McCann writes, the skeleton obsession reminded me of a few real-life situations. First, I have moderate OCD, which my therapist often refers to as sticky brain. I notice things others don't. I tend to assign more meaning to things I notice than the average person, and my brain relentlessly brings up the thought no matter how logically I dismiss it. For example, my internal monologue might go, my scalp has an itch. Did the kids bring home lice? No, scalps itch sometimes, and there's no evidence it's anything more than that. But what if it is lice? No, that's silly. But what if it is? Etc. And of course, thinking about lice makes your scalp itch more. So I sympathize with Mr. Harris on that score.
Yeah, sure, I'm scratching my head right now. Thanks for that.
The story also reminded me of things like Morgellons disease. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right or not. Morgellons disease and chronic Lyme disease. Neither has any scientific support as a physical disease, but both are manifestations of a mental problem. Victims believe they have mysterious fibers infesting their body, or that they have insidious bacteria that doesn't respond to standard treatments. These beliefs cause real suffering, but many physicians write them off with annoyance, as the doctor does in this story. This pushes people to find quack practitioners who often do more harm than good by encouraging the delusion and prescribing dangerous quote-unquote remedies, very much like Munigant does.
Yes.
Good stuff.
Adventure Hook, hey, great podcast, writes, the Ray Bradbury Theater adaptation of the story is ridiculous, and yet it is nearly identical to the written story. Eugene Levy was definitely out of his element. His performance is ham-fisted and cringeworthy at times. It kind of highlights how a lot of these stories really should not be seen visually. The moment you place it in the real-world context, it turns metaphor into absurdity, and the final scene with jellied Eugene Levy is just laugh-out-loud bizarre.
I agree with that, and I fast-forwarded to that to see what they did with it. It's ridiculous.
The adaptation of The Jar was pretty good, though it put in absolute definition point on the end of the story, confirming that he does kill his wife and put her head in a jar. For the most part, though, I'm finding that Ray Bradbury Theater kind of did a disservice to his work. It turned very poignant stories into camp parodies.
Yeah, I agree. That show's hard to watch. And it's not just because it's a little out of date. I do remember watching it in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And not liking it that much.
Right.
As much as I liked Ray Bradbury. Even when I was a kid, I thought, meh.
Yeah.
Not that into this TV
show. I didn't like it either, yeah.
Peter Larson writes, I was disappointed. Everyone talks about how original Bradbury was, but this is a pretty typical boy meets skeleton, boy loses skeleton, doctor eats skeleton plot, the likes of which we've seen over and over. Pretty good one, Peter. All right, that gets us into the third story of the month, which was The Lake. And we had some various disagreements over this story.
Oh.
Christine McCann writes, I guess one person's poignant is another person's maudlin. I found the story just irritated me, despite the amazingly skilled evocation of place and mood. Maybe part of it is the sentimentality about being 12 doesn't reflect my experience at all. Perhaps being a girl is part of it. By the time a girl is 12, she's grappling with puberty, and her friend groups are becoming way more political and tricky to navigate. It's hard to connect that experience with the nostalgia for simple, pure friendships and innocence.
Hmm.
Yeah. I mean, a few people didn't hook into it. I mean, I don't think you have to really share the particulars of the protagonist in terms of gender or age or anything like that to get the sentiment. That's how I felt.
Yeah.
And certainly you didn't. You even said on the show, you know, I didn't have friends like that when I was 12. But
no.
I think you were still able to relate to it.
So. Yeah.
But you know, that's what happens. Some things just don't connect. I get it.
Of course. Audrey Peterson writes, I have a vivid memory of my 10th birthday down the shore with my mom and dad and younger brother. Nothing spooky per se, just remembering how wonderfully unself-conscious I was running around in a red, white, and blue bikini, and how that last look at the beach out of the car window at the end of the day always made me melancholy. I didn't know then it was a reminder that I would never turn 10 again. This story invokes some of that feeling.
Hmm.
Yeah.
This person felt differently. Danielle writes, like most others, I found the story to be a very poignant meditation on the meaning of love, loss, and change. I could even see that the protagonist was simply settling with his current wife because the person he wanted to be with was forever gone. That leaped out to me at the very moment he says he found a woman and got married. He describes her like an object, like he would a retro Starsky and Hutch lunchbox he found on eBay. Not like a great person he found who makes him feel complete. So he settles for the lunchbox and gets married because that is what you were supposed to do after all.
The lunchbox.
It'd be rad if the story is about him marrying a Starsky and Hutch lunchbox. I hate to be a Debbie Downer, but by the end I was ruminating over the story and it hit me. This is a paint-by-the-numbers example of stuffed into the fridge, which is the name of a trope.
Oh, okay.
A male writer creates a female character for the sole purpose of killing her in order to create character development for his male protagonist. Sigh.
Hmm.
I'm not a big fan of that. I mean, I kind of think any character who dies in something you write is somebody you invented to kill. So, I mean, I don't know how I feel about that trope necessarily. But Danielle continues, as an amateur writer, I have trained myself to deconstruct every story I read or watch. I look at how the writer put it together and try to understand why they did the things they did. That is the only way to learn how to be a better writer yourself. I've also trained myself to look for these bad tropes in my own writing. And yes, I have committed them myself. But I have also scrapped stories because I realized they were founded on bad tropes, or went back and rewrote large portions of them. Like you guys said before, as a writer, you have to be willing to kill your children. Now, I'm not saying that Bradbury is a misogynist bastard. I don't think he was gleefully cackling away on his throne of skulls as he banged this out on his typewriter. But the truth is that ultimately it did not come away with even a bittersweet feeling from this story.
Hmm.
So, another person that I didn't like at camp.
Yes, yeah.
And this prompted some discussion on the comment section. Christine McCann writes, I find that Bradbury is very much, in all caps, a product of his time, and seems to have trouble getting away from the perspective of a white male born in the Midwest in 1920. I agree that it's not malicious, just a deficit that's all the more jarring because he writes so well overall.
Richard Lyman writes, I think you're over deconstructing. Why deconstruct everything? You end up with nothing. It's so easy to just reduce things down to tropes and power structures, and you remove all joy from art. Chagath Lord writes, art would be just as joyless if one approached it uncritically and just absorbed it passively without ever really thinking about any of it, though.
Matthew Buston writes, I thought that considering was written by a white cis male member of the patriarchy, it was pretty good. But seriously, some of the comments here are kind of why I didn't take English Lit at uni. It's good to explore a text's themes, but over-analysis based purely on postmodern theories on power structures is tedious. So this went back and forth and more people joined in on this conversation. I thought it was a really good conversation and I can actually see everybody's point.
Yeah.
I think people can read a text however they want. And I do think there's a lot to be learned from deconstruction and critical points of view, critical readings of a text.
Yeah.
Especially, I think that one needs to learn how to shift their perspective on texts and think about how somebody who's maybe not in your group or in a mainstream group might react to it.
Mm-hmm.
I think a good example of that would obviously be Lovecraft. I mean, I read that stuff for years and didn't perceive racism in it because it's simply I was reading it for the monsters and not really focusing on it in a critical way. And I don't need to because I'm a white dude. But when I started to shift my perspective and think, okay, you know, I'm a black guy reading this. Oh, shit, this really jumps out to me. You know,
right.
And so there's changing your perspective, I think, can really enrich your enjoyment of something. And you also have to realize some people aren't having these reactions to texts because they're trying to apply a critical deconstruction of power structures. They're just reacting to it that way.
Yeah.
And it's not the same reaction as yours, but it doesn't mean it's any less legitimate. That said, I don't think you have to deconstruct everything. Certainly, if it sucks the joy out of something for you, just don't get involved in that discussion. I mean, there are a lot of things where I just want to read it to read it. Same way I'd eat a piece of candy. Mm-hmm. I don't really want to think about what's in that candy, you know?
Right.
And then some things I think about what the ingredients are. So I guess this is kind of a wishy-washy argument. I'm saying everybody's point of view is legitimate, but I really do believe that. I remember taking crit lit in college and having similar reactions where I was like, oh my God, do we have to break everything down?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you're in literary criticism. You do have to break everything down. You know, I did carry some learnings out of that experience.
Sure.
And how to shift my perspective and how to think about that stuff. So I think there's value in it. You know, don't jump on somebody's back for doing it. But if it's something that you react to, you go, you're taking the fun out of it, then I think just don't participate in the discussion is all I'm saying.
Sure. Now for this particular story, I felt a very deep emotional connection to it, and it made me feel a lot of things.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know, looking at it critically, I can see that there are flaws with it or issues that may mean it's not really necessarily as good or it could have been better, and whatever that means, you know, from whatever your perspective is. But for me, on a personal note, it did its job. It did what it was supposed to do, and I believe what Bradbury's intent was. And so in that regard, I think that it is very successful for me.
Sure. And I actually, you know, I connected it to an experience from my own life, and I assume that folks would be able to do that. I don't know if it's the story's responsibility to appeal to everybody all the time.
Well, you can't. It's impossible to do that.
No. But certainly, you know, for some people, they're not gonna. This example of this type of feeling or this type of nostalgia just isn't going to work for them. The other thing, though, I would say in response to Danielle's comment about tropes and going through your own work as a writer and trying to eliminate all of those and watch out for cliche and this kind of stuff, I think that's good in practice to do, at least be aware of those things. But I also think don't be overly concerned with that stuff. Not that you're asking for my advice.
Here we go.
I think that there are only so many situations that humans find themselves in. There are only so many ways to resolve conflict. If you get too hung up in this, like, I've got to be completely original and I can't work in something that's a trope, you're going to have a really hard time. Like, so much of writing is in the detail and the approach and in the language and in the way that you tell a story. Mm-hmm. Sometimes these stories are just as old as human experience, though.
Yeah.
In fact, one thing that I had a really good time doing at one point, when I had a writing teacher, and he would say, think of things that are totally cliche. Now take that cliche and go write a story. Because the more you avoid it, the less you're actually learning how to be a writer.
Huh.
We've given this example before, but how many times do you want to see a mobster go to a therapist? You can go see Analyze This, or you can go see The Sopranos. Same premise, totally different results.
Yeah.
I mean, there are so many times you can take something that's been done over and over and over again. There's a guy in a you know, the lone stranger that comes to a Western town. Okay, write it, but make it new and fuse it with what you know about the world and what your perspectives are.
Yeah.
I think that we, in fact, sometimes I think that people like these tropes. These tropes work for a reason because they appeal to some human experiences that we all share.
I agree. A trope is very familiar to us and can be useful in that regard, that people can connect to it. And you want to connect to a story and then offer something new and something insightful. Maybe you start off with a trope, but if you take that trope in a new place, then you're actually using it to advantage.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're trying to examine tropes in your writing, look at, did I do that because I'm lazy? If that's the case, cut it out. But if you did it because it just makes sense for the story, then it's fine.
Yeah,
it's totally.
I agree.
It's totally fine.
The Writer's Beard Show. What? The Writer's Beard Show is a patron of ours, and they commented, really moving episode. Near the end, when Chad is talking about his own experience and how losing someone you love at a young age allows you to put them on a pedestal in your mind, making them seem perfect really resonated with me, especially the line about, if she had just lived, I would have been happy for the rest of my life. I lost my first real love in a car accident around 15 years ago, and I think about her that way sometimes, even though our relationship was pretty dysfunctional and not good for either of us. But all these years later, time is still slowly rubbing away at all the terrible things we did to each other until only the shiny happiness of that time in my life is left. Just as in the story, it can really poison you if you let it. The Dead by James Joyce jumped into my mind as a good companion piece to the story if anyone is looking to follow the theme a little deeper. Now, if you'll excuse me, I need to find out who put all these tears on my cheeks.
It's true, The Dead by James Joyce is an excellent companion piece for this. I love that story. It's very sad, and yeah, that's one that hit me in the feels as well. Mike Nussbaum writes, "This is my first post after supporting you from the beginning." Well, thanks, Mike.
Oh, thanks.
This episode made me tear up. You conveyed it so well that I was truly moved. I haven't read through all the comments, but at the end, divergent from your opinions, it made me think of PTSD and repressed memories. As someone who's been battling PTSD, I thought the narrator was remembering something that he had repressed due to its emotional weight. He did see his love pulled from the surface as a young man. This is how memories can work. I don't think it's a supernatural story. I think his memories were released when he finally went back.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a cool perspective.
Wow. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
It's something that he actually did see back then, but...
Oh, wow.
He blocked it out.
Elisheba writes, "So far, all Bradbury stories seem to involve a man who really dislikes his wife. Maybe I'm reading too much into that. I am kind of okay with being one of the small percentage of listeners who is an idiot."
There was certainly a trend around that time, and I don't know what it was societally, but, you know, whenever you read horror comics from that era, man, wives are not good people. They're always cheating or stealing money or gold digging. And
Hold on. Skeleton, she was really nice.
That's true.
She was really supportive and cool.
Yeah, that's right.
So you're not 100% right. You're just 75% right.
Billy Launder writes, "Well, consider me a paid-up idiot. When it came to the wet face, I thought I was listening to HP Podcraft and naturally concluded a sea beastie was on the attack.
Aww.
The only things under attack were my feelings." Excellent reading, guys. I'm really enjoying these Bradburys. Awesome. That gets us into Jack in the Box. Shoggoth Lord writes, "Chad, is it possible you were thinking of the short story that Twilight Zone episode was based on? It's quite good, but the sequence of events in it aren't quite the same as the episode, even if the premise are identical between them." And the story he's talking about is It's a Good Life by Jerome Bixby. I don't think so, but to be honest, I couldn't even tell you if you presented it to me what story I was thinking about. I just gave Chris some bad information.
Jason Thompson writes, "Do it together with Small Assassin and you'll have 50% of Evil Kid Month."
Yes, Evil Kid Month, huh?
This is a great idea. So tell us what other Evil Kid stories to cover.
Yeah, if you've got some suggestions for Evil Kid Month, we'll totally do it. That sounds like a blast. Jeff C. Carter writes, "I thought the story was winding up to a super dark ending. The kid sees the jack-in-the-box down below, free and smiling, and with no understanding of death, he jumps off the roof."
Ooh.
That seems very logical, actually.
Yeah.
But I didn't think of it at the time.
No. Jeez.
Good job, Jeff.
Way to bring it down even further.
Yeah. Ugh.
Christine McCann writes, "As a mother with anxiety, I find this story a great reminder that overprotection has huge risks itself. You literally cannot keep your kids safe. To avoid messing them up by sheltering them, you have to literally and figuratively let them go out in the world and risk being run over by cars." Yeah, as a father with anxiety, I know exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, it's got to be hard to let the kids cut loose and bang themselves up a little bit.
It is.
Marcus Lauer writes, "For some reason, I've always read an incestuous motif into the story. I realize there's little to no actual text to warrant such a take on it, but somehow I imagine the final triple-locked door as the door to the couple's bedroom, which the boy gets to enter on his 21st birthday, thereby fully assuming the father role in the household."
Yeah, I didn't see that specifically, but there was definitely an unhealthy relationship that was going on.
Yeah, I didn't think it, my mind didn't go there, but now that it does go there, yeah, I think that that's textually, I think it's supported.
Mm.
It's just not explicit.
Yeah. Christine McCann writes again, "I actually think that the text supports this. If the father was God, he's going to ascend to become God. That could sure imply sexual relationship with his mother. I've also speculated on the final door being the master bedroom, but maybe I've just been watching too much American Horror Story." Pete Williams writes, "I'm glad other people picked up on that. I was a bit worried about myself. Perhaps the reason his birthdays were speeding up was reflective of her own impatience."
David Halstead writes, "Yeah, dude, let's get off that topic. It's grossing me out." David Halstead writes, "Funny you bring up the new Addams Family animated movie. The plot of that movie is Wednesday has been locked up in the mansion her whole life and wants to see the outside world.
Huh.
Morticia is reluctant, recalling the persecution the family faced for being different." That's awesome. I didn't know anything about it, so it's cool that synced up.
Michael writes, I felt so much sympathy for Chris on this one. For almost every book I had to read in high school, I would write a long-winded interpretation of the story from my own perspective. Then, whenever we would discuss it in class, I would quickly realize I completely missed what was actually happening in the book. It put me off literature as a whole, and now, as a student in mathematics, I hardly read anything except textbooks. I'm glad I have a podcast like this to keep me interested in the kinds of stories I love without bearing the ridicule of a professor who already has their own idea about the meaning of a story before I've even read it. If there's one thing I've learned in my higher education, it's that you shouldn't feel dumb for having a new idea. Yeah.
That's great to hear.
And I'm glad that my misinterpretation, and I think it was important that that was left in the show and that Chad didn't straighten me out beforehand, because that happens sometimes.
Sure.
All right, so on to the topic show, Halloween strategies.
Yes, Jimmy Mack writes, I love the remake the bad movie question. John Huston used to say that people should remake near misses and good ideas gone wrong.
Mm.
That's, I agree with you, John Huston. Along with Plan 9, I would love to know what other horror films people would remake. Yeah, I'd love to know that too. Now, remember, they can't be good ones. So if you've got some real crap sandwiches out there that had a nugget of something good in them. Oh, that whole metaphor is terrible.
Oh, God. Stacey Schumacher writes, great episode. We have a couple of guys that clipped their nails in our office. Oh, my God. Mm. And I had to move into one of their cubicles. I did not like what I found. Good thing we have an office vacuum. Oh, my God. You had to vacuum up other dudes' nails? Oh. I find myself hoping they were fingernails because toenails seem way worse. They are. Probably the same reason that I agree bare feet should not be inflicted on the wider public. No one's feet. A compromise of clean sock feet is tolerable.
Agreed. Clean sock feet, okay. Yeah. But some people in these comments were coming out in support for plane and movie theater feet. No. You know what I like perspective, you know, as I was saying earlier, I like to get everybody's perspective on this issue. No, if you're talking about how you can take your shoes off on a plane to get your feet out, don't comment on the show. Nobody wants to hear that kind of talk. It'll have you, you're going to wind up in the cellar is what's going to happen.
Oh my gosh, Chad, this got really dark. And I'm going to contradict you and say that people, you can talk about whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
However, I cannot guarantee you will not end up in the cellar.
I can't guarantee you won't now.
What? Wait a minute.
Should have talked back.
Okay, so Stacey's got some more here. She says, for horror movie world, I'd be in Event Horizon because you get all the in-system space travel without xenomorphs or predators. Just stay away from that one ship, right?
That makes sense.
I think I'd choose being a ghost, but only if I wasn't bound to one location because that could get so boring. Maybe haunt an item, like a painting, so you could move from place to place. Otherwise, I'd go with werewolf to avoid unpleasant limitations of ghost or vampire. Werewolves in human form are usually depicted as stronger and faster than normal humans, right? That'd be nice to have without exercise. So yeah, I'm thinking werewolf.
I didn't think of that, but that just, supports my decision from that show, definitely.
There you go.
If I could have the strength and the speed and I didn't have to go to the gym, that would be amazing. David Halstead writes, wow, I work at a movie theater and I've heard complaints about both people taking their shoes off and people clipping or biting off and spitting out their fingernails.
Oh, God.
What is my grossest complaint at the theater so far? The person next to them was getting a handy from their girlfriend.
Oh, my God.
That's okay. That happens, but there's a twist. The movie hadn't started yet and the lights were still up. That should have been italicized in the comments. That's so funny to me. When I read that, I was like, oh no!
The lights were still up. What?
Yeah, you came to the movie theater. If it's sparse in there and the lights go down, you know, you'll have your chance. But while the lights are still up, why didn't you just do it out in the
And people are still walking around.
The cafeteria.
And, jeez. Not that I condone it while the movie's going on. I'm just saying, like.
No!
What? That's crazy.
That seems counterintuitive.
Yeah.
And then he continues, I would take the ghost and werewolf pills together and become the ghost of a werewolf, obviously.
Yeah, makes sense. Steve writes, the Frankenstein thing explains why Chris comes around to my house every autumn. Also, one of my wife's friends bought a place that had been owned by a dentist. There might have been a surgery in the house because the back garden had loads of teeth in it.
Oh, boy.
What?
Yeah, so they were probably removing teeth and then just tossing them in the back.
Oh, whoa.
In the surgery. But that would be, that would be a pretty horrible thing to discover. I think what Steve's talking about is that you said if you would be in the novel Frankenstein, but you would befriend the monster.
Oh, right, yes.
And he's saying that's why you come around to my house, comparing himself, I believe, to the monster, which isn't fair, Steve.
That's not even remotely close. Steve is a treasure. There's nothing monstrous about Steve. Louis Hobbs writes, I would be a vigilante vampire, only drinking the blood of murderers. Kind of like a Dexter of ghouls.
Well, then Pete Williams writes, I liked Forever Night when I was a kid and will never try to watch it as an adult.
That's good thinking.
Which, yeah, because when he said I would be a vigilante vampire, I kind of immediately thought of Forever Night. Because he was a vampire, he was a cop, right?
Yep, that's right.
Somebody said, oh, it's not that bad, you should watch it. This is the comment that was one of my favorites. Pete goes, maybe I'll give it another go. I did recently watch Baywatch Nights Season 2 and enjoyed it. They were desperately trying to ape the success of The X-Files by making them investigate paranormal events. There's even a Dagon episode, which basically makes Baywatch part of the mythos.
What? I heard about that. The Baywatch Nights has got supernatural stuff in there, but I did not know there was a Dagon episode. That kicks
me neither,
ass.
But I mean, just there's a lot in play. I mean, just that Pete was like, I watched Baywatch Nights Season 2. That means that he went out and got it. And probably if he's watching Season 2, he probably watched Season 1 as well. And just like, that is hilarious to me. I'm not making fun of you, but just that somebody went, you know what I want to... There's a lot of stuff coming out these days. It's golden age of television, but you know what I want to binge? Baywatch Nights.
Baywatch Nights. I don't play. I'm honestly
maybe
curious.
Maybe I'm missing something. Yeah, because...
I've heard things about Baywatch Nights, so I'm actually curious myself. I empathize with Pete.
Yeah, at first it struck me as funny, but now even now when I'm saying it out loud, I kind of want to watch it.
Yeah. Daniel Wiley writes, I may have missed this in a previous comment, but when discussing the odds of something happening in the Star Wars universe, the correct response would be, never tell me the odds. Nailing that reference would have been like bullseye womp rants in my T-16 back home. If I was more clever.
Oh, I thought of it in the episode, but I didn't say it. I really did. I mean, how can you not? As any child of the 70s, my head is full of Star Wars quotes all the time.
Oh, yeah.
I think that around the late 90s or early aughts, I just got sick of the references, though.
Yes.
Too many things exploiting the Star Wars references, and I thought, I'm going to stop quoting and doing that, which is sad, but true. I think it was like I read some satire of the way Kevin Smith writes, and instead of using periods in his work, he just used the word Yoda. That was pretty accurate. And then I went, man, that's probably how I sound. Does everything need to compare to Star Wars? Forget it. The Screaming Moist writes, the slightly accusatory, I hope you're happy at the end there made me laugh so hard I spit out my coffee. Yeah, and that was, of course, that horrific last question.
Oh, boy. Asked,
which some people addressed in the comments section, but luckily not too many folks.
Oof.
Well, that's all we've got for the comments show, folks. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you're enjoying Povember.
Yes, Povember has been very enjoyable for me, and I'm looking forward to next month. But for now, I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to
the HP Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
Exclusively on Patreon.